Here's my thought. Of course, the biggest difference between Florida and Florida State is, of course, that we're the ones with all these championships the last few years, right? In both football and basketball. All right. Yes. Okay. Now, since you let me choose the topic, first I'm going to tell you what I'm not going to talk about. Yes? First, predictions of what the LHC will or will not discover, because I have no idea, okay? And whoever tells you with a straight face that they know what the LHC will discover, I mean, they're lying, okay? Second, I'm not going to tell you about the model that I've been recently working on for several reasons. First, it's probably wrong, right? Any given model that you've heard at this conference is most likely wrong, okay? The second reason is that I'm not a model builder, right? So you guys are going to say, why should we listen to you? You're not a model builder. We'd rather listen to Nima or Chaba or Raman or somebody, yes? But nevertheless, in case you're interested, I'll tell you that I've been working on the UMSSM, and my postdocs insist on using this abbreviation, and I realize I always have to explain what it means. So it's the NMSSM with an extra U1, right? And then you require that this is non-anomalous, which requires exotic quarks that have been discussed. And for good measure, let's throw in a right-handed neutrino, which is light, okay? And now that it could be a dark matter candidate, yes? Since normally the right-handed neutrino doesn't have any interaction, so cannot thermalize and cannot annihilate efficiently. But now that we have this extra U1, we can use it. And the right-handed neutrino can annihilate either through Gaginos or through the Z prime, and you could get the right relic density, yes? But the point I want to make is that in supersymmetry, since the left-handed neutrino doesn't work, we're used to thinking that in supersymmetry, the dark matter candidate is a Majorana fermion, right? And it's not true. It could be a scalar, okay? Now, whether it's a right-handed scalar, like in my model, or left-handed neutrino, which is created non-thermally or somehow, or a mixed neutrino, like Neil was mentioning earlier today, well, we don't know. So if that turns out the case, we're going to have to duke it out and figure out who's right, right? So that's not what I'm talking about. Instead, what I'm going to talk about in this talk is jokes, right? And in between the jokes, I'm going to have some physics, all right? Now, why? Look at the time. It's 8 o'clock on these calls, all right? And you guys are tired, I'm tired, so we're going to have lots of jokes. Also, I learned from my undergraduates that you have to give out homework during the talk, because otherwise they're not going to pay attention. They're going to be reading their email, opening their laptops, and so forth. So you better pay attention, so there's going to be homework, okay, for time. And my talk is going to have two parts. Yes, in the first part, I'm going to give a general classification of the new physics signatures, and there's basically two types. You either hunt for bumps, or you're doing bean counting, and you're counting and counting, and you get confused, and so forth. And then in the second half, I'm going to talk about techniques for mass measurements and spin measurements. And the talk is supposed to be pedagogical, because originally it was scheduled for the first day of the conference, yes? Luckily, no one, you know, discussed all these things in detail, so my talk is very complementary to what you heard from Ian and many other people who were giving talks here at the conference. And my discussion will be very model independent, okay? So it's not going to be Suzy, it's not going to be UED. If Suzy is your favorite model, think of it as Suzy. If UED is your favorite model, think of it as UED. But mostly it's going to be model independent. Okay. Since it's a conference in anticipating of the LHC, I have to show you my inspirational slide, okay? Often people, especially from other fields, say, you guys are hyping up this LHC thing too much, right? How do you know that you'll find anything new or interesting in the LHC, yes? And to this question, I give two answers, yes? The first one is the physics answer. We haven't found the Higgs, so we're either gonna find the Higgs or something else in place of the Higgs, okay? This is the officially licensed poster from Fermilab. Unfortunately, you're going to notice it doesn't have the Higgs. So, Joe, you better check out what's up with that. I mean, no wonder Fermilab can't find the Higgs. I mean, it's not on their poster. Now, a man on the street in New York City will understand this argument, but the man on the street in Gainesville will not understand this argument. So I have to give another sociological argument that everybody can understand, okay? The energy at which the LHC will eventually operate, not the 10 TeV, but the 14 TeV, is 7 times larger than the currently available energy. And a factor of 7 is a big thing. It's unprecedented, okay? Well, maybe the first accelerator, when you go from 0 to whatever, then it's a bigger factor, but it's a lot. Now, in order to help you realize how big a factor this is, you can take your annual salary right now, yes, and multiply it by a factor of 7. So you're going to get a huge number, okay? And the zeros may shock you, so to help you out, I'm including this plot, yes? And if you're a poor postdoc, you make somewhere here, and then that's how much your annual salary will be by a factor of 7 inflation, yes? On the X range, on the X axis, I plotted only the range that would cover the salaries in our department, yes? If your salary falls up outside the range, well, you make so much money, you should be able to do this calculation yourself, right? So, what do we do for a living? That is a tough question, okay? A month ago, they had bring your parent to the daycare day, yes? So I have to go and explain to the four-year-olds what do I do for a living, right? I had a hard time, all right? And so they liked the smashing part, okay, that was cool. But then they were lost, okay? And at the end of the day, I said, well, Daddy just sits in an office and plays with a computer all day. And they said, cool, I want to be a theoretical physicist. Seriously. So what we do for a living, we look for new particles, okay? And there's two types of signatures. There's two ways we look for new particles. We do bump hunting or beam counting. So if you make the new particle, and it decays, and you see all the decay products, then you can go back and reconstruct the invariant mass of the particle, and you look for a bump over a smooth background. This is an excellent way to look for new particles, because you can do the sideband subtraction. Here's your background, yes? You fit, you subtract, and whatever is left is a peak, okay? You don't need theorists to do that. The experimentalists can do this all by themselves because they measure the background from data, right? It's also easy to do mass and width measurements because you just look where the peak is, right? And so there won't be all these complications that I'm going to talk about in the second half of my talk, right? And the important thing that I want to emphasize here is that this is the kind of surge that is more likely to be done, and perhaps successful if there's new physics of this type, with the early LHC data, okay? So if you're thinking, what can we do with the LHC at the beginning, this is what you should be thinking about, right? There's also a second way by which we can find new particles. Well, we make some processes, we look for excess of events at the tails, and since Andrew already showed this plot, I don't have to explain it again, yes? You may get very confused, especially if it's a missing energy like this, because you get a lot of junk, and until you understand the junk, you cannot make any definite statements about this. Since he already explained this plot, I'll give you a different, layman's analogy. The problem here is normalize your expectations, okay? Especially if you're a rookie, you don't know what you're doing. So, let me give you an example. So last year, with my wife, we planned some orange trees in the air, right? Because it's Florida. You gotta have citrus trees in the air. If you don't, everybody looks at you funny, right? So we plant the trees, and this year we get like 2 or 3 oranges on every tree. Now, was it a good year or not? We have no idea. There's no oranges in Bulgaria, so how would I know? So my expectations are uncertain, yes? So it's worth thinking about the bump hunts now, right? Because if there is a paper coming from the LHC in the first 2 years with the word evidence or discovery in the title, well, I don't know if there's going to be a title like that, but if there is, yes, it is much more likely that the title will also contain the word resonance than the word excess. Okay? I think everybody is going to agree on that. So let's think about bumps in the first half of the talk. What is nice is that it is possible to give an exhaustive and systematic classification of all resonance searches you can think of. Unfortunately, I mean, the experimentalists are not doing that. We're not doing that, so the purpose of my talk here is to advertise this classification. It's very easy, because you answer just two questions. First, how many new resonances do you make per event? Well, typically you make only one. Sometimes, if there's some conserved quantum number, you make two, maybe. And then the next question is, what does this resonance do? How many objects does it decay to, and what are these objects? And when I say objects, you have to think in terms of the experimentally reconstructed object in the detector. Now, by now, everybody has run PGS, and so you know what the objects are. Yes, they are muons, electrons, jets, and photons. Notice that there is no missing energy calorimeter, right? What that means is that if you want to get missing energy, you have to measure everything else that's happening, and you have to be sure that all these components of the detector are working very well. Okay? Until you get to that point, there's just no, there will be no missing energy plot. So the exercise that Nima showed, it's great, but we're not going to get those plots in the first year. Okay? You'll have to wait a little bit more to get there. Okay? So, what happened? Okay, so here's my, I'll give you my classification. So for simplicity, let's start with the case where we make only one resonance, and this resonance decays to two objects. And these two objects could be any combination of those guys. Okay? So let me make a table, since there's two objects, yes? I'll put all the objects on this side, I'll put all the objects on that side, I'll block half of the squares, because, you know, they're just duplicates of those. And each box here is giving me one signature, right? Now, it's important to notice the order in which I put these guys, right? Because every experimentalist knows muons are better than electrons, electrons are better than photons, photons are better than jets. Now, here, we may have a debate, which jets are better than which. Joe and I would have said taus are better than the others because they come from leptons and it's not QCD, right? But then I talked to my experimentalists, and they said, no. Taus are trouble, okay? You have to understand tau tagging efficiency, you have to understand mistagging efficiency, forget tau. What about B-jets? No, forget B-jets. B-jets are trouble. What you want is QCD jets. Those are simpler. Then you don't have to worry about tagging and all that stuff, all right? So I put the QCD jets here, and they could be the quark or gluon, right? In principle, yes? Thank you. So this box corresponds to two types of searches, like sign and opposite sign. So you can have, if it's opposite sign, it's something like a Z prime. If it's like sign, something like doubly charged key. Yes. So this is very simple, just to introduce the idea. Of course, you can generalize it. And now, of course, you can also generalize it because you can say, well, wait a second, out of these guys, I can form something that's a Z, right? If the invariant mass of the two leptons gives me the Z mass, so then I can call this a Z object. We've heard today how to reconstruct taus, yes? So maybe I have a tau in the event, or maybe W, and so forth. But okay, you get the picture, right? There's no resonances, by definition here, that involve neutrinos, right? And this is clearly nothing, okay? Now, is everybody clear? Any questions? Because now comes the homework. Here's the homework. Now, I also learned from my undergraduates that you have to start with the easy exercises and progress towards the more difficult to build up confidence, okay? So the first one is very easy, right? So you think of all the models that you've worked on, okay, and you ask yourself, how many of these resonances did I have in my model, all right? And I've put in some examples here, you know, Z prime Higgs. This would be something like a leptoquark and W primes here. But I'm not going to do the homework for you. It's your job to continue and fill out the rest of the table, okay? So this doesn't require you to read any papers or whatever. Just think of what you've done in the past, okay? Probably, by the time you're done here, there's going to be many empty boxes. If you're someone like me who's been working on, you know, supersymmetry with R parity conservation for all his life, I mean, there's no resonances, right? There's always missing energy. So then, if you have any empty slots, then let's think about the following. Why are they empty? Well, is it that there is a model, but I just didn't work on it. Okay, or maybe there is some fundamental reason why there is no such resonance. Okay, if there is, if you can think of a fundamental reason, let me know, because I might be able to convince you otherwise. Yes, and then if we both fail, yes, we should go and tell the experimentalist. Why? Because if you tell them that there's something, yes, that you know the theorist, that no theory has ever predicted this thing, yet there's no fundamental reason why it should not be there, they're going to go and start looking for it twice as hard, right? Because then it's a sure Nobel Prize if you see it, okay? So you just think that the experimentalists are asking you for guidance. No. All right. But it could also be that, you know, the slot is empty because you never worked on such a model, and then your job is to think of a model among the myriad of models that were talked about at this conference and early on, and see where such a resonance might exist, yes, and may give you an observable signature. Okay? Is it clear? That's a straightforward exercise. Then we move on to the really hard stuff. Okay? Next. Find out whether you're a member of Vizier or CDF or Atlas or CMS. Okay? That's relatively easy. But then the highly non-trivial part is to figure out what is the list of topologies or signatures in my language that they're looking for. Okay? If you try to go on the web and look for them, no. But typically you fail. You try to Google, get to the secret website, you fail. Okay? So finally, I go to my CMS colleagues and I ask them, what is the secret list of signatures that you look for? And they give it to me. And I look at it, and it is, unfortunately, yes, defined not in terms of these experimentally observable signatures, but it's defined in terms of models. So they say, we're going to look for third generation leptoquark. What does that mean? I don't know. Probably they don't know what it means either. So the lesson is that we should be classifying our inclusive resonance searches this way, okay? Because experimentally, this is the very, very clean and very straightforward way to classify the search. And only then you start asking the question, is there any model that's going to give me this signature? So my lesson for the experimentalist is, don't think in terms of model. Think in terms of experimental signatures that you guys understand very well. Okay. Finally, yes, and not surprisingly, well, look at the searches that they're going to be looking for and see if they're covering the whole table. Yes? You can guess that they're not, right? And so if they're not, if they're empty boxes in the planned searches of CMS or Atlas or CDF and so forth, then try to convince them, if you have a good example, to go ahead and do this search, especially if the empty box appears in the upper left corner of this table. Because remember that I ordered these in order of easiness, yes? Mu E at CMS is already taken, because as soon as I looked at our table, I figured out nobody's looking for mu E. Our group is looking for dimuons, yes? We're going to be looking for dielectrons, but we're not planning on, we weren't planning to look for muon electron resonance, yes? You may say, where's that coming from? Neutrino with air parity violation, whatever. Okay, you can always come up with a model that does this. Okay? And then talk to your friend, experimental friend, and try to advertise the theory models that would give these missing signatures. All right. Now, it's not enough to just assign homework. Then you have to explain to the undergraduates why they should do the homework. Okay? So I'm sure you're going to learn something that you didn't know, because unless you're able to fill out the table from the very beginning, I mean, you're going to have empty slots and you're going to learn about some models that would give you those signatures that you weren't thinking about previously. When you talk to your experimental colleagues, you'll be able to teach them about their missing signatures. And to finish the first half of my talk, yes, again, I want to emphasize the point that bumps are easier, and they're more likely to be the first new physics discoveries in the early data. So if you're a theorist, actually you can go back to my table here, and you can do the following. You can prepare a LaTeX draft with the title Explanation of the Observed Resonance in Signature Block. Okay? And then you just wait for the LHC to start turn on. And you wait and you wait, and as soon as the paper comes out, you post it on the web. Yes. You have to be ready with your explanation, right? You could be ready with your explanation right now, okay? Because this is what they're going to be looking for at the very beginning. I forgot to mention that, of course, these are di-object resonances, so maybe your resonance decays to three particles. Then you can simply extend this table up and give it one more dimension, then you get more boxes like this, okay? All right. Now, in the second half of the talk, yes, I'm going to talk about missing energy signatures. So this is the beam counting type where you don't have any resonances, any sharp features, yes? These are much more difficult, as Ian explained yesterday. You have to calibrate your background, and ideally you want to measure it from data. But a lot of us have been spending time on missing energy signatures because they're very well motivated by the dark matter argument. They're not guaranteed, but at least the motivation is very strong and compelling. But the problem is, apart from the experimental issues, is that model dependence when you talk about missing energy. Since, you know, as Jay said this morning, you don't measure missing energy, you measure missing momentum, and so it's important what recoils against the missing particles, and that necessarily introduces model dependence because you have to specify what those particles are. And here I'm going to talk about this famous, very well-known cascade. You make some particles that decays to a jet, and then later on something decays to a lepton, another lepton, and this is presumably the guy that gives you the missing energy. Wait a second. Oh. And then we're going to think that this is the dark matter guy, we're going to measure its properties, we're going to compare it to cosmology, and then there's a triumphant merging of particle physics and cosmology. Not so fast. Because what happens to the last guy, to this guy? We don't know. All you know is that he didn't leave a deposit in the detector. So what may have happened to this last guy is something like this. This last guy may have decayed invisibly. And you will have no idea. So then you can measure the properties of this guy all you want, but you're not measuring the dark matter guy, you're measuring some other guy over there. The dark matter guy is here. Or maybe not. How about this? Maybe that guy also decayed later on, and then that's really the dark matter guy. Okay, so there is a confusion. And I think it's clear that no matter how long you run the LHC is always going this way. Starts from the left, goes to the right, and at some point you get stuck at this last guy, at this guy A, and you don't know what that guy is doing anymore. So in order to answer the question, what is the spectrum of these invisible particles? You need a machine that's going to probe from the right side, yes? And that machine is the linear collider. Now, that's a conference on the LHC. Am I allowed to show plots on the linear collider? Yes? Okay. So, at the risk of being ridiculed and getting tomatoes thrown at me, yes. So, you can do this at the linear collider. In fact, some years ago, we predicted the rate of production of dark matter particles at any collider, as a matter of fact, not just E plus E minus, based on detailed balancing and the information that we get from cosmology. And so, since you know how fast WIMPs annihilated in the early universe, you can just turn the diagram around, use detailed balancing, and you get a prediction for the cross-section at any collider for pair production of two WIMPs. And these are really the dark matter guys, okay? And this cross-section is predicted in terms of two continuous parameters, the mass, and how much of the annihilation is into E plus E minus, and then the spin, and whether it's a P-wave annihilator or S-wave annihilator. This result is exact, it is beautiful, and it's totally useless, because it's unobservable, right? You make two dark matter guys, and you don't see them in the detector, actually you don't even trigger on them, so it doesn't work. Now, they're not coming at you waving little red flags. And actually, even if they did, you still won't see them because there's no little red flag waving trigger, right? You have to always think in terms of triggers. So then you have to tag them, and we propose to tag them with an initial state photon. You can do this at the linear collider. At the LHC, you would have to do either photon or jet, but then you get monophoton, monojet signatures. There's two big backgrounds. And you can even measure the mass of these guys at the LHC, since you know the center of mass energy, the center mass energy is fixed, and so this photon has a cutoff at a certain threshold that depends on the mass. So if you do a detailed study of this single photon signature of DLC, you could even provide, it can even provide a mass measurement with some precision. But now let me go back to my argument here, yes? And now let's consider the case where you actually have two guys at the end, actually, and maybe the heavy guy decays to a light guy, or maybe there's just two completely independent dark matter candidates. Who said that the dark matter is made up of a single particle? Right? We're not made up of only one particle. So it may very well be that the dark matter guys are more than one, okay? And what I'm going to do here is show you a preliminary study where we consider two dark matter guys, yes, two different masses, M1 and M2. Let's pick some nice round numbers that are within reach of the LC, 100 GeV, 200 GeV. And let's consider, just as an example at first, that they're both contributing equally to the Rayleigh density. So 50% of the dark matter is one, the first guy, 50% is the second guy. And then we look at the data that we have, and now we fit to a two dark matter guys template, and we try to measure the mass and the rate for each one. And if there's no polarization, actually, we cannot find the second guy, because you see these blue points, which are consistent with the data, extend all the way up to here, 250 GeV for the second guy, which will give you no signal. So essentially, you only discover one guy at 100 GeV, and that's it. But if you have polarization, yes, then you get a nice ellipse, and that tells you that actually there's two guys, because you measure the mass of the first one, and you measure the mass of the second one. So this is kind of a scenario which is neither optimistic nor pessimistic, because the cross sections for these, both of these, were more or less what you would expect for a normal wind. But you can then consider a case where one guy makes up most of the dark matter, and there's a second guy which is also stable, also dark matter guy, but it makes very little of the dark matter. This is because it has a big annihilation cross section, okay? And if it has a big annihilation cross section, it gives us a huge signal. So actually, that guy is even more easier to discover at the ILC. And so there's a nice complementarity, right? So the guy that is irrelevant for astrophysics, we can see very well, okay? Kind of. Now, going back to my diagram here, yes? In the last part of the talk, I'm going to discuss how you can possibly try to make a discrimination between the different models that would give you these particles, GCBAA, right? So far, I did not specify what these particles are. They could be anything, okay? So there's different methods that you can approach this problem. One method is to start raising money, and once you get to the several billion dollar range, you can start thinking about an LC. And then at the LC, you can easily tell the difference between all of these guys. This is a plot that Hitoshi showed on Monday, except he showed two plots, and he pointed to the right one and said, see, it's very hard at the LC. But if he had pointed to the left one, which was this one, it's obvious that it's very different, and he, you know, the LC can do it. So I just counted in the break, so there's at least five or six ways in which you can tell the spin at the LC. Right? And Michael can probably think of more, but those are the ones I know. If you think raising several billion dollars is too hard, what you can do is you can try to actually reconstruct the momentum of this last guy, okay? And there's been some very recent and very nice work by Jack and collaborators, yes? And if you're lucky and you have lots of luminosity, actually you might be successful, yes? I have nothing more to say about that. Yes, it's a promising avenue to pursue further. But if you think that this is too hard, then you can do what, you know, most people have been doing so far, just look at the visible particles here and try to look for correlations between them and figure out what the spins are. Okay, so there's been lots of work on this. The problem is that when you do that, you're not really measuring spins per se, because all of these correlations, so what you do is take the invariant mass of these guys, and then those guys, and those guys, and then all three. But these distributions depend on all of these things. They depend on the spin, they depend on the masses, They depend on the type of couplings that you have here. You saw you remember yesterday Ian said in the old days people were fitting to, you know, A plus B gamma 5 type couplings, and this is exactly what you should be doing right at the LHC if you see this, because you have no idea what these couplings are. And finally, it also depends on, you know, the fraction of particles versus antiparticles that you make in the initial state, and this is because it's a PP collider. Okay? So there's more particles in the proton than antiparticles. So to avoid this confusion, we should try to start eliminating these factors one by one until we can get to the spins alone. Okay? So what I'm going to do here is tell you a little bit about the mass measurement. If it's not new to you, if you've heard all this before, then consider yourself an expert in the field, yes? If you haven't seen this or heard this before, then it's going to be new, so it will be useful. So let's see, how are we going to do mass measurement? Well, Ian alluded to this earlier, and today I'm going to point out that there's some difficulties. They can be overcome at the end of the day, but nevertheless, one should be mindful of those. So let me take this this diagram again. And instead of talking about the four masses, let me factor out the scale, so the mass of the heaviest guy, and then all these other ones, I'm going to consider ratios of masses squared. So mass squared is a very useful thing. The mass is useless, okay? If you do this kind of business, you should always think in terms of masses squared, okay? Because everything is much simpler in terms of mass squared. And then what you do, you form all possible invariant mass distributions. They have endpoints, you measure four endpoints, and you solve for the four masses here. Okay, so you have four measurements, four unknowns, should be sufficient. Not so fast. There is one, two, three, four difficulties. I'm going to illustrate all of them here. Okay. First, let's start with the simplest case, the near and far leptons. Well, when the leptons come out, they don't carry a label near and far, so you don't know which one is near, which one is far. But if you take the invariant mass of the two, you don't care. And then you get this famous triangle, yes? And there's an endpoint, and here's the difficulty. This endpoint is ambiguous, because unless you know what is the hierarchy that you're looking at, it has two meanings. Either the lepton in the middle of the diagram is on shell, in which case this is the predicted endpoint as a function of the lepton mass. There's a formula involving all the three masses that Nima wrote down on the board. Yes, look it up. Or the lepton is off shell, and then you're measuring the mass difference between the guy that I call C and A, those are the two neutralinos in the case of supersymmetry. So this example nicely illustrates two of the problems I had on the previous transparency. First, there's a problem with the interpretation of the endpoint. And second, the equation here that you have to solve is nonlinear. So if you're here, you actually get two solutions. There's one solution here, there's one solution there, and you don't know which one is right. Okay? So you need more data. So let's get more data. Let's look at the quark lepton-lepton invariant mass. So you take QLL, you combine them all, you make a distribution. There's an endpoint right there, yes? Even more trouble, because there's one, two, three, four cases in the on-shell case and two cases in the off-shell. So now you have six possibilities. Which of these formulas should you use? You don't know. So you have to use all possible combinations and then test for consistency at the end. Then you take the quark lepton mass. Well, now these are the near and far, but you don't know which is which, so you order them in mass, you form you take the larger number, you put it on one plot, you take the smaller number, you put it on the other plot, both of these have endpoints. Three different formulas in the on-shell case, one formula in the off-shell case. So many, many, many combinatorial possibilities. So to recap, yes, let me limit myself only to the on-shell case. Even there, there were three cases for this distribution, four cases for that distribution. I get 12 different formulas, sets of formulas that I can have to solve in terms of the endpoints to figure out the masses. Well, not 12, because these three are not possible, you know, never. So it's really only 9. Okay. Bad news. What I didn't tell you that is that in this region, and that region, the endpoints of these three distributions are actually not independent. It's an identity. This equation is an identity. So your measurements are not independent. So instead of having four measurements, you have only three measurements. How are you going to determine four masses out of three measurements? You can't. Okay? So these guys are not independent. I should point out that People have not stumbled upon this in their literature because, you know, people usually do minimal supergravity. Minimal supergravity, because the quarks are so heavy, it always ends up here. So, I mean, the end of my analysis, I'll show you that in that case there's no ambiguity. But these cases are, you know, away from M. Sugra could have this problem. So we need an additional measurement, and it's known how to do that. Again, this is not new, I did not invent that. You take the dilepton plot, you focus on the right end, where the dileptons have large invariant mass. That means that in the rest frame of the C, they're kind of back to back, right? And so if you put a cut here at 1 over square root of 2, you're picking the dileptons that are at least 90 degrees back to back or more. And then you make a new distribution. That distribution has a lower endpoint. You measure that one. That gives you the extra information, the extra piece of information that you need in order to resolve this ambiguity. And the bad news, well, the formula is complicated, but the good news is there's only one case for that guy. There's a unique formula. It doesn't depend on the region. So then what are we going to do? We're going to say, well, forget this guy, because this guy in those regions was linear, it was dependent on the others, was not independent measurement. So instead, let's replace this guy, which had four cases, with the new measurement, which has only one case. So now from 9, I get down only to 3 possibilities. So this tells you that if you have a perfect experiment and you measure all the endpoints perfectly, you can get at most 3-fold ambiguity for the Suzy spectrum, not more than that. Okay? So now that's the good news. So then what do we do? Well, we know how to calculate the endpoints from the spectrum. Let's invert the formulas for these three cases, 1, 2, 3. So now we know how to calculate the endpoints, how to calculate the spectrum in terms of the endpoints, yes? And there's three cases which are, or three regions which are nicely shown in this plot, RA over RB. It doesn't depend on the third ratio. And you have region 1, 2, 3. So now this is what we do, okay? Suppose we pick a point in this region. We calculate the endpoint, and then we invert using the formulas for the other two regions and see if we can get a consistent solution, whether there's a duplication between any pair of regions here. What we find is that if you pick a point in region number 2, there is always another solution which satisfies all of the endpoints that you have, even all five of the endpoints, yes, which exists in region number 3. And furthermore, if you have a point in region number 1, there's always another duplicate pair which sits up there in region number 3. So therefore, in more than half of the parameter space on this plane, so in all of this parameter space, there's going to be some duplicate solution. Okay? Three. Okay, here's one. So to illustrate this, again, you can pick a point in this region number 2, and there's always a duplicate solution over there. And this is not such a crazy hierarchy, because actually the Gugino unification line is here. So I'm sitting on the Gugino unification line. So this is a model which has Gugino unification, and then just the quarks are changing. So there's also, and then you can extend this further in the next. And I can go this way, and again, there's the duplicate guy over there. So the bottom line is that we have duplications. So here's another example, okay? Just one more thing. So now, how do we resolve this? Yes? We can resolve it, but to do that, we have to look at the two-dimensional plot. And one of the take-home lessons that I would like you to take home with you from today is that two-dimensional plots have more information than one-dimensional plots, okay? And I've been trying to educate experimentalists, yes, that when they show plots, they should be using two-dimensional plots, because they always project that way, and then we spend 1 hour trying to figure out what's happening when you can just look at the two-dimensional plot and see what's happening. So here's the two-dimensional plot of the near and far distribution, but those are unobservable, remember? So I had to reorder them. And so reordering means fold. So you're doing origami, right? So fold along the 45 line, yes? And if you have a 4-year-old or 4 or 5-year-old, go home, you start cutting shapes like this and try to fold them and convince yourself that there's only 3 shapes you can get. This and this and this, and these nicely correspond to the 3 different regions that I had. So to resolve that ambiguity, you have to look at the shape in the QL low, QL high distribution, and if you can tell those shapes from each other, yes, then you can resolve the ambiguity. Ah, I should mention that I think these duplicate solutions that we find in the language of Niemann, Gordy, and Liantao correspond to the sliders. Okay, so those are the sliders. So now we have exact analytical expression that relate the two sliders. Last one. Okay, so far all I've done is eliminated the dependence on the masses. Okay, so now if you want to talk about spins, you still have this dependence on the spins, on the chirality of the couplings, and on the initial state. And what I claim is that, okay, previous studies, with the exception of two, they fixed the couplings, fixed the initial state, and then they say, oh, we're merging spin. But if you allow me to fiddle with those two, yes, I can fit most of these distributions to more than one model. Okay, and in the remaining slides, you can see that this is really true. Okay, so when I say yes, that means that we've derived the analytical formulas for all these distributions, and you can stare at the analytical formulas and convince yourself that you need to always choose the parameters so that they give you identical answers. When I say no, that means that just by staring at the analytical formulas, they will be different. But whether you can measure that in practice, that depends on the resolution, combinatorics, and all that stuff that I didn't talk about. So no really means maybe, okay? Yes really means yes. So that's the end. So my conclusion. Okay.
Great. So in the 3 minutes before we run to eat, does anybody have any questions for Constantine? Jack?
I mean, of course, all those shapes you gave were before any smearing of lepton momenta or jet momenta.
Because my goal was to find cases where they're identical at the theory level. If they're identical at the theory level, it doesn't matter how much resolution you have, they're still going to be the same. That's why I said, if you find them, they're different at the theory level, then you have to worry about the experimental resolution. And this is work in progress. So we're working on all these other cases that might be distinguishable, because then you have to work.
So just as an advertisement for what we did, we put all that in.
If you can fully reconstruct the event, all this ambiguity goes away. So if Jack's method can be realized, then forget what I said in the second half of the talk. Yeah. We're on the same page here.
You claim it can be realized.
Okay, we have time for one more question if anyone wants to ask one. Well, in that case, let's thank our speaker again and adjourn for dinner.